A prophet named Nathan came to King David with a story. Nathan tells the king, "There were two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had very many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had bought. And he brought it up, and it grew up with him and his children. It used to eat of his morsel and drink from his cup and lie in his arms, and it was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the guest who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him." David, the king of Israel, heard this story and he was irate. And he told Nathan that the rich man who had done this to the poor man deserved to die. Having David right where he wanted him, Nathan turned to David and declared, "You are the man." King David, the richest and most powerful man in the realm, had taken the wife and then the life of one of his citizens. David was guilty. But to do the dangerous work of confronting a powerful king, Nathan needed to put David on the hook by getting him to agree in advance that his own behavior in another lesser form was wicked and worthy of judgment. You can find this whole story in 2 Samuel chapter 12. The book of Amos opens in a similar way. A prophet named Amos is called by God to confront the rich and the powerful and the wicked people of the northern kingdom of Israel. But Amos is a hated southerner. And just a poor shepherd at that. How could Amos ever get a hearing? How could Amos possibly expect to survive this dangerous mission? Well, Amos starts by railing hard against all of Israel's neighbors. And each message begins with an announcement of three transgressions, no, four, against one of the neighbors. And then this clear declaration that punishment is coming. And then on to the next one and next one. First, Amos calls out the Syrians to the north. And his audience cheers, "Three transgressions, no, four. Three transgressions, no, four." Amos calls out the Philistines. And the cheers grow louder, "Punish them, punish them." Amos calls out the people of Tyre, and then Edom, and then Ammon, and then Moab, and you can just hear the fervor growing. Three transgressions, no four! Three transgressions, no four! It reminds me of the way that audiences respond to Donald Trump at his rallies. As he calls out his political opponents, stirring up excitement in the crowd, the crowds grow louder and they start chanting things like fake news, or lock her up, lock her up. But this is really where the comparison ends, because Amos, the prophet, then takes it a step further, announcing God's judgment, turning toward himself and his own people. Amos, a southerner, announces to his northern rivals that God's judgment is coming upon the southern kingdom of Judah. Amos riles up the crowd against his own people. And at this point, I mean, the people of Israel are in a fever pitch. They are crying out for God's justice to be done against God's enemies. They're chanting that God's judgment might come. And then Amos announces, "Three transgressions, no, four, on you, the northern kingdom of Israel, punishment is coming." Amos goes in on them. "You have rebelled against your God. You have trampled the poor. You have ignored the afflicted. You have committed sexual immorality. You have done worse than all of the surrounding nations. But because you demanded God's judgment on your neighbors, you stand guilty, accused of your own words, accused by your own words, judged by the measure that you use to judge others. The prophet Nathan had used this clever strategy to help a powerful king see his own sin. The prophet Amos had to use the same strategy to help the northern kingdom of the Israelites to see their own sin. This is exactly what Paul is doing in the first two chapters of Romans. After a 17-verse introduction, Paul jumps right into the accusation. Take a look at Romans 1, verse 18 with me. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. Paul is announcing judgment on all who are ungodly and unrighteous. Paul goes on to describe their rebellion against God. Since the beginning, God has been revealing himself so that the ungodly and the unrighteous are without excuse. But they waste their minds and they harden their hearts and they replace the Creator at the center of their lives in order to worship and serve created things. And so God has given these ungodly and unrighteous idolaters over to their disordered passions, and they've filled their lives with every sort of unrighteous act, all kinds of evil, covetousness, and malice. If you're wondering who Paul is talking to and who Paul is talking about, know this: Paul's audience knew exactly who Paul was talking to in this moment and exactly who Paul was talking about. And there's a reason why Paul hasn't identified the target of his judgment. He doesn't have to. He's just playing off a stereotype that would be familiar to everyone. Think about it kind of like this. If Jeff Foxworthy tried to go to another country and tell some of his famous you might be a redneck jokes, he would bomb hard. Why? Because a redneck is a distinctly American stereotype. You would have to explain way too much to people from other countries where we would just immediately get the joke because it's kind of part of our culture that we've grown up in. Paul is drawing on Jewish stereotypes of Gentiles. And he's using this classic stereotypical description of the Gentiles to get his audience worked up. These exact descriptions with almost identical lists of sins have been found among Jewish writings from around the first century. So who are the ungodly and the unrighteous? The nations, of course. Who are these idolaters who reject God and worship created things like statues and people and animals? Gentile pagans, obviously. Paul's list of sins: gossip and slander, hating God, insolence, pride, boasting, inventing evil, disobeying parents, foolishness, faithlessness, heartlessness, and ruthlessness. Who does this sound like? Gentiles. Who else? But then Paul goes in for the setup. Just like Nathan and Amos before him, in chapter 1, verse 32, Paul announces the punishment that these wicked Gentiles deserve. He says, though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but they give approval to those who practice them. Paul has his audience feeding out of the palm of his hand. Any faithful Jewish person would be nodding along with Paul the entire way, knowing exactly where he's going. But Paul's audience isn't just Jews in general. The Jewish people he's addressing are members of the Roman house churches. They're followers of Jesus who also happen to be Jewish. And as they are listening to this letter, calling out a hearty amen to each of Paul's judgments against these Gentile sinners, these Jewish followers of Jesus are sitting right next to Gentiles. Some of them are listening to this very letter in the home of a Gentile believer. This immediately catches our attention. These Jewish Christians have brought their stereotypes and their judgments and their biases and their ways of thinking into their faith in Christ, into the church, which shows us how important Paul's instructions are in chapter 12 when he tells these believers that they need to have their minds transformed and why they can no longer be conformed to the pattern of this world. So his audience has been set up. Paul announces that the ungodly and the unrighteous, who should know better, deserve to die because they reject the truth. And you can imagine Paul's Jewish listeners offering him enthusiastic support as they imagine Gentile sinners punished by God for their sins. Yes, they're surrounded by Gentiles, but these Gentiles are different. But maybe not all that different in the hearts and the minds of these Jewish believers. And then chapter 2 begins. Paul says, "Therefore, you have no excuse, O man, every one of you who judges. For in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself because you, the judge, practice the very same things." Paul goes on to then speak in these pretty general terms for a little bit. And to us, as 21st century readers, it's not totally obvious that Paul is speaking to Jewish Christians. But then in verse 17, it comes, not in the form of a derogatory stereotype, but in the form of all of the things the Jewish people liked to say and believe about themselves. In fact, here, Paul is using another famous strategy for confronting people with the truth. Paul uses their own words, their own values against them. He says, "But if you call yourself a Jew, and you rely on the law, and you boast in God and know his will, if you approve what is excellent because you have been instructed by the law, and if you are sure that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in the darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of the children, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you who then teach others, do you not teach yourself? While you preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say one must not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples?" Paul then drops the hammer. "You who boast in the law, dishonor God by breaking the law." Consider what Paul has done here. He has set Jew and Gentile side by side using all of the famous stereotypes about the Jews or the Gentiles, as well as the Jews' own words about themselves. And he's done all of this to demonstrate the Jews are no better off than the Gentiles, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, Paul declares, and all are made right by his grace as a gift, through the redemption that is in the Messiah, Jesus. Jew and Gentile are in the same boat, Paul argues, and his whole case revolves around the law. The Gentiles never received the law, and thus never knew God, not in any sort of direct way. But according to the stereotype that the Jewish people had of them, according to the Jewish judgment against them, they should have known better. And we've heard people say stuff like this before. Someone comes from a rough childhood, maybe they dropped out of school, their parents were addicts or just not engaged, and then they get into trouble. Maybe they hurt someone or make a foolish decision. And we're often quick to say, Well, they should have known better. Just because they didn't have parents doesn't mean they can't know the difference between right and wrong. This is what the Jews claimed about the Gentiles. They were ungodly and unrighteous, but they had every opportunity. And so when the Gentiles break God's law, it's because of how terrible they are, how rebellious, how wicked. But Paul flips the script upside down. He asks the Jewish Christians, if the Gentiles didn't have the law and they knew better, then what's your excuse? God gave you the law, told you what was expected of you. He gave you story after story of his patience and his character, and you boast that you have it, that you have been given it, that you are special or better. But so what? What difference does it make in your life? Seriously, I mean, you're no better off than the Gentiles who were never given the law, and so you dishonor God with all of your talk about its importance. What is Paul doing here? Why is he calling out his own people? Paul is walking straight into one of the core issues keeping Jewish and Gentile believers from living as siblings in one, as one family. The Jewish followers of Jesus have been looking down on Gentile followers of Jesus, plain and simple. See, in the Jewish mind, these Jewish believers, these Jewish Christians haven't been able to shake the ways that they've always been trained to think of the nations, to think of the Gentiles. And they just think Gentiles equal sinners. Gentiles are sinners. They are dirty and unrighteous and idolatrous. Now, these Gentile believers who are gathered here in this house church supposedly share faith in Jesus, but the Jewish Christians want to know, where is the evidence? Because if they really believed in the God of Israel, wouldn't they get circumcised? Because that's what the law says to do. That is the sign of true belief. Or is it? It might feel like Paul takes us in circles in this passage, but he is making a clear point. And he circles back to it again and again in a variety of clever ways. In chapter 2, verse 13, Paul says, it's not the hearers of the law who are righteous before God, but the doers of the law. In other words, hey, you Jewish Christians who spent your whole life hearing the law, you know that simply hearing the law isn't what made you right with God, because many of you hearing it never did it. You're not right with God because you're able to say what you should do in any given situation because you know the law. You know that Jesus came to rescue you, to do for you what the law never could do for God's people. And this is the place where Paul digs the knife in a bit. Verse 14, he says, when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness. Paul is dismantling both the positive conception that the Jewish Christians have of themselves and their people, and at the same time, Paul is rebuilding a brand new vision of who the Gentiles are. See, in the minds of Paul's Jewish audience, the Gentiles can only ever be ungodly and unrighteous. This is why they need to become Jewish. Right? They need to receive the law so that they can know God's will, so that they can obey and they can become holy. They can be cleaned up. They can become dignified. And then, when everyone looks and speaks and eats and lives a bit more Jewishly, this community called church will be a bit more unified. course, we know that that's not true, that even among the Jewish people who had this very distinct culture, there was deep division among them. And Paul's having none of this. The Jewish believers have some serious issues that they have to grapple with. Like, for instance, why do circumcised Jews who say the law is important then go on to break core moral elements of it? And at the same time, how is it possible that uncircumcised Gentiles who apparently don't have the law, who God has supposedly given over to a debased mind and disordered desires, are out there living lives of holy love? Paul comes to a simple and obvious conclusion. Circumcision can't tell you anything about the condition of a person's heart. It's not physical circumcision that changes you, that makes a person holy. It is by the Spirit alone that a person is welcomed into the family of God. It is by the Spirit alone that a person is transformed. Circumcision can't tell you anything about the condition of a person's heart. Human beings constantly want to look at the external rather than what is beneath the surface. That is why we continue in the church today to be obsessed with things like the number of people that attend a congregation. Although just like circumcision, the number of people attending a congregation can tell you nothing about the heart or the health, the well-being of any congregation of believers. The issue that Paul is dealing with is pretty straightforward. Jewish followers of Jesus were never saved through the law or by the law. It wasn't the law that brought them into the family of God. It's not the law that defines the boundaries of the family of God. It is Jesus alone. Jewish believers were saved only by the gracious acts of their Messiah, who won their salvation through his faithfulness. And they have experienced deliverance only as they have trusted Jesus and followed him and opened their lives to the Spirit. And just as this is true of Jews, it is also true of Gentiles. But now these Jewish believers are struggling to trust that this very same Jesus, this very same Spirit who saved and is transforming them, is capable of doing the exact same work in a Gentile believer. They're a bit too far gone. And Paul has a harsh final judgment against his Jewish believers. In 2:24, Paul accuses the Jewish believers of blaspheming God's name among the Gentiles. In other words, they are taking God's work through Jesus to free us from slavery to sin and death. They are taking God's work through Jesus to circumcise our hearts. And they are saying, we don't need any of that. We just need to follow some rules. You Gentiles, you just need to follow the right rules. We just need to become culturally Jewish. That will save you. That will transform you. That will make us one. But this is utterly blasphemy, according to Paul. And Paul devotes four whole chapters right here at the front of his letter to calling it out. In chapter 1, Paul gets his fellow Jewish believers on the hook, and he gets them to declare their own guilt before God, so that in chapter 2, he can make it abundantly clear that Jew and Gentile are on a level playing field. Sin is the same for both. Grace is the same for both. Both are in need of the Spirit, not the law. In chapter 3, Paul then goes on to describe the value of the law, that it is actually still a good gift from God, even if it doesn't have the power to save or transform. And so God's people should still learn from it and still let it teach us, but it is simply incapable of doing for us what God himself does for us in Jesus and through the Spirit. And then chapter 4 takes the argument and considers it in light of Abraham, the father of the Jewish people and also the father of many nations. Looking at Abraham's life and faith, Paul shows that circumcision was not a saving act. It was a sign that God had acted. But the act didn't have any power in and of itself. Any faith that Abraham had was purely a gift of God. It was a gift that led to obedience. And this brings us all the way around to Paul's purpose. Paul describes his own mission in chapter 1 like this. He says he is a servant of the Messiah Jesus. He has been called to be an apostle to bring about the obedience of faith among all the nations. Summarized, Paul's job is to bring the Gentiles into obedient faith. Jump all the way to the end of the letter. Look at chapter 16. Notice Paul's final prayer in the final paragraph. Now to him who is able to strengthen you according to God's command to bring about the obedience of faith, glory be to God through Jesus. It's simple. Paul's mission is to bring the Gentiles into obedient faith. By the time Paul is done with these Roman house churches, they too should be able to bring the Gentiles to obedient faith. Currently, the Jewish believers want to bring the Gentiles into submission to the law. But Paul sets out to remind them, you can follow rules and never have a change of heart. And he's simply reminding them what Jesus taught, that you can live your life and never murder someone, but still do incredible damage to the world and to the family of God through your anger and your bitterness and resentment and scorn. Paul's reminding them that you can go your entire life without ever committing adultery, but still do incredible damage to your marriage and your family and the church with a lusting heart. Paul knows that you can easily create the illusion of unity by forcing a sort of conformity. But Paul understands that if the churches in Rome are going to live as one, if they're going to be unified, if they're going to live as a single family, if the church in Rome, these churches spread throughout the city, are going to be a light showing off the love and life and light of Jesus, it will not be because the Jewish believers convince the Gentile believers to get circumcised and start eating kosher. If the churches in Rome are going to live as one, it will be because women and men who have encountered the living, resurrected Jesus, who have experienced his forgiveness and welcome and loving kindness, have been freed to love each other as siblings. Paul summarizes the law this way in chapter 13. Love each other. For the one who loves has fulfilled the law. The commandments are summed up in this word. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. And Paul seems to think that as we draw near to Jesus, as we let the Spirit have her way in our lives, we will become people, whether Jew or Gentile, capable of this sort of faithful obedience, faithfully obeying the law of love. Obedience not to a set of rules, but obedience to the one who is love and who has loved us even unto death. This morning's passage is both an encouragement to us and also a warning. Let it encourage you to seek Jesus, to draw near to him and trust him deeply. He alone is the source of your transformation. He alone is your welcome into the family of God. But may this passage also be a warning to us, that we might not ever replace Jesus with a set of rules or any other kind of external behaviors or experiences that cannot change a heart. There is a place for rules in our lives, but our rules cannot be the rules for everyone else, and our hope, our trust, cannot be in the rules. The Jewish Christians, they knew better. But it was only a matter of time before they forgot. especially in the face of these wild and sinful Gentiles who needed to get it together. The amazing thing is that over time, even these Gentiles would begin to replace obedient faith with new sets of laws that they would impose on others, laws incapable of changing anyone's hearts. This is always a danger. And thus Paul's letter continues to be a gift for the church, a gift to us. May we hear it and be encouraged. God sees us in our sin, and he foreordained to send his son to deal with it and set us free from its power. Jesus is the answer. May we be encouraged and warned by this good news. Amen.